Sneakers by Stephen King, read by David Cronenberg. John Tell had been working at Tabori Studios just over a month when he first noticed the sneakers. Tabori was in a building which had once been called Music City and had been, in the early days of rock and roll and top 40 rhythm and blues, a very big deal. Back then, you never would have seen a pair of sneakers unless they were on the feet of a delivery boy above lobby level. Those days were gone, though, and so were the big money producers with their reed pleats and pointy-toed snakeskin shoes. Sneakers were now just another part of the Music City uniform. And when Tell first glimpsed these, he made no negative assumptions about their owner. Well, maybe one. The guy really could have used a new pair. These had been white when they were new, but from the look of them, new had been a long time ago. That was all he noticed when he first saw the sneakers in the little room where you so often ended up judging your neighbor by his footwear because that was all you ever saw of him. Tell spied this pair under the door of the first toilet stall in the third floor men's room. He passed them on his way to the third and last stall. He came out a few minutes later, washed and dried his hands, combed his hair, and then went back to Studio F, where he was helping to mix an album by a heavy metal group called The Deadbeats. To say Tell had already forgotten the sneakers would be an overstatement, because they had hardly registered on his mental radar screen to begin with. Paul Jannings was producing the Deadbeats sessions. He wasn't famous in the way the old bebop kings of Music City had been famous. Tell thought rock and roll music was no longer strong enough to breed such mythic royalty. But he was fairly well known, and Tell himself thought he was the best producer of rock and roll records currently active in the field. Only Jimmy Iovine could come close. Tell had first seen him at a party following the premiere of a concert film, had, in fact, recognized him from across the room. The hair was graying now, and the sharp features of Jannings' handsome face had become almost gaunt. But there was no mistaking the man who had recorded the legendary Tokyo sessions with Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, John Lennon, and Al Cooper some 15 years earlier. Other than Phil Spector, Jannings was the only record producer Tell could have recognized by sight, as well as by the distinctive sound of his recordings. Crystal clear top ends, underscored by percussion so heavy it shook your clavicle. It was that Don McLean clarity you heard first on the Tokyo Sessions recordings, but if you wiped the treble, what you heard pulsing along through the underbrush was pure Sandy Nelson. Tell's natural reticence was overcome by admiration, and he had crossed the room to where Jannings was standing, temporarily unengaged. He introduced himself, expecting a quick handshake and a few perfunctory words at most. Instead, the two of them had fallen into a long and interesting conversation. They worked in the same field and knew some of the same people, but even then Tell had known there was more to the magic of that initial meeting than those things. Paul Jannings was just one of those rare men to whom he found he could talk, and for John Tell, talking really was akin to magic. Toward the end of the conversation, Jannings had asked him if he was looking for work. "Did you ever know anyone in this business who wasn't?" Tell asked. Jannings laughed and asked for his phone number. Tell had given it to him, not attaching much importance to the request. It was most likely a gesture of politeness on the other man's part, he thought. But Jannings had called him 3 days later to ask if Tell would like to be part of the three-man team mixing the Deadbeats' first album. "I don't know if it's really possible to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear," Jannings had said, "but since Atlantic Records is footing the bills, why not have a good time trying?" John Tell saw no reason at all why not, and signed on for the cruise immediately. A week or so after he first saw the sneakers, Tell saw them again. He only registered the fact that it was the same guy because the sneakers were in the same place, under the door of stall number one on the third floor men's. There was no question that they were the same ones, white, once anyway, high tops, with dirt in the deep creases. He noticed an empty eyelet and thought, "Must not have had your own eyes all the way open when you laced that one up, friend." Then he went on down to the third stall, which he thought of in some vague way as his. This time he glanced at the sneakers on his way out as well and saw something odd when he did. There was a dead fly on one of them. It lay on the rounded toe of the left sneaker, the one with the empty eyelet, with its little leg sticking up. When he got back to Studio F, Jannings was sitting at the board with his head clutched in his hands. "You okay, Paul?" "No." "What's wrong?" "Me. I was wrong. I am wrong. My career is finished. I'm washed up. 86th. Over. Done with. Gone." "What are you talking about?" Tell looked around for Georgie Ronkler and didn't see him anywhere. It didn't surprise him. Jannings had periodic fugues, and Georgie always left when he saw one coming on. He claimed his karma didn't allow him to deal with strong emotion. I cry at supermarket openings, Georgie said. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear, Jannings said. He pointed with his fist at the glass between the mixing room and the performance studio. He looked like a man giving the old Nazi Heil Hitler salute, at least not out of pigs like those. Lighten up, Tell said, although he knew Jannings was perfectly right. The deadbeats, composed of four dull bastards and one dull bitch, were personally repulsive and professionally incompetent. Lighten this up, Jannings said, and flipped him the bird. God, I hate temperament, Tell said. Jannings looked up at him and giggled. A second later, they were both laughing. 5 minutes after that, they were back to work. The mix, such as it was, ended a week later. Tell asked Jannings for a recommendation and a tape. Okay, but you know you're not supposed to play the tape for anyone until the album comes out, Jannings said. I know. And why you'd ever want to, for anyone, is beyond me. These guys make the Butthole Surfers sound like the Beatles. Come on, Paul, it wasn't that bad. And even if it was, it's over. He smiled. Yeah, there's that. And if I ever work in this business again, I'll give you a call. That would be great. They shook hands. Tell left the building which had once been known as Music City. And the thought of the sneakers under the door of stall number one in the third floor men's john never crossed his mind. Jannings, who had been in the business 25 years, had once told him that when it came to mixing bop, he never called it rock and roll, only bop, you were either shit or Superman. For the 2 months following the Beats mixing session, John Tell was shit. He didn't work. He began to get nervous about the rent. Twice he almost called Jannings, but something in him thought that that would be a mistake. Then the music mixer on a film called Karate Masters of Massacre died of a massive coronary, and Tell got 6 weeks' work at the Brill Building, which had been known as Tin Pan Alley back in the heyday of Broadway and the big band sound, finishing the mix. It was library stuff in the public domain and a few plinking sitars for the most part, but it paid the rent. And following his last day on the show, Tell had no more than walked into his apartment before the phone rang. It was Paul Jannings asking him if he had checked the Billboard pop chart lately. Tell said he hadn't. It came on at number 79. Jannings managed to sound simultaneously disgusted, amused, and amazed. With a bullet. What did? But he knew as soon as the question was out of his mouth. Diving in the Dirt. It was the name of a cut on the Deadbeats' forthcoming Beat It Till It's Dead album, the only cut which had seemed to Tell and Jannings remotely like single material. Shit. Indeed it is, but I have a crazy idea it's going to go top 10. Have you seen the video? No. What a scream. It's mostly Ginger, the chick in the group, playing Mudhoney in some generic bayou with a guy who looks like Donald Trump in overalls. It sends what my intellectual friends like to call mixed cultural messages. And Jannings laughed so hard Tell had to hold the phone away from his ear. When Jannings had himself under control again, he said, anyway, it probably means the album will go top 10 too. A platinum-plated dog turd is still a dog turd, but a platinum reference is platinum all the way through. You understand this ting buena? Indeed I do, Tell said, pulling open his desk drawer to make sure his Deadbeats cassette, unplayed since Jannings had given it to him on the last day of the mix, was still there. So what are you doing, Jannings asked him. Looking for a job. You want to work with me again? I'm doing Roger Daltrey's new album, starts in 2 weeks. Christ, yes. The money would be good, but it was more than that. Following the Deadbeats and 6 weeks of Karate Masters of Massacre, working with the ex-lead singer of The Who would be like coming into a warm place on a cold night. Whatever he might turn out to be like personally, the man could sing. And working with Jannings again would be good too. Where? Same old Stan Tabori at Music City. I'm there. Roger Daltrey not only could sing, he turned out to be a tolerably nice guy in the bargain. Tell thought the next 3 or 4 weeks would be good ones. He had a job. He had a production credit on an album that had popped onto the Billboard charts at number 41, and the single was up to number 17 and still climbing. And he felt safe about the rent for the first time since he had come to New York from Pennsylvania 4 years ago. It was June, trees were in full leaf, girls were wearing short skirts again, and the world seemed a fine place to be. Tell felt this way on his first day back at work for Paul Jannings until approximately 1:45 p.m., Then he walked into the third floor bathroom, saw the same once white sneakers under the door of stall one, and all his good feelings suddenly collapsed. They are not the same. Can't be the same. They were, though. That single empty islet was the clearest point of identification, but everything else about them was also the same, exactly the same, and that included their positions. There was only one real difference that Tell could see. There were more dead flies around them now. He went slowly into the third stall, his stall, lowered his pants, and sat down. He wasn't surprised to find that the urge which had brought him there had entirely departed. He sat still for a little while just the same, however, listening for sounds. The rattle of a newspaper, the clearing of a throat, hell, even a fart. No sounds came. That's because I'm in here alone, Tell thought, except, that is, for the dead guy in the first stall. The bathroom's outer door banged briskly open. Tell almost screamed. Someone hummed his way over to the urinals, and as water began to splash out there, an explanation occurred to Tell, and he relaxed. It was so simple it was absurd, and undoubtedly correct. He glanced at his watch and saw it was 1:47. A regular man is a happy man, his father used to say. Tell's dad had been a taciturn fellow, and that saying, along with clean your hands before you clean your plate, had been one of his few aphorisms. If regularity really did mean happiness, then Tell supposed he was a happy man. His need to visit the bathroom came on at about the same time every day, and he supposed the same must be true of his pal Sneakers, who favored stall number one, just as Tell himself favored stall number three. If you needed to pass the stalls to get to the urinals, you would have seen that stall empty lots of times, or with different shoes under it. After all, what are the chances a body could stay undiscovered in a men's room toilet stall for... He worked out in his mind the time he'd last been there. 4 months, give or take? No chance at all was the answer to that one. He could believe the janitors weren't too fussy about cleaning the stalls, all those dead flies, but they would have to check on the toilet paper supply every day or two, right? And even if you left those things out, dead people started to smell after a while, right? God knew this wasn't the sweetest smelling place on earth, and following a visit from the fat guy who worked down the hall at Janice Music, it was almost uninhabitable. But surely the stink of a dead body would be a lot louder, a lot gaudier. Gaudy? Gaudy? Jesus, what a word. And how would you know? You never smelled a decomposing body in your life. True. But he was pretty sure he'd know what he was smelling if he did. Logic was logic, and regularity was regularity. And that was the end of it. The guy was probably a pencil pusher from Janice or a writer for Snappy Cards on the other side of the floor. For all John Tell knew, the guy was in there composing greeting card verse right now. Roses are red and violets are blue. You thought I was dead, but that wasn't true. I just deliver my mail at the same time as you. That sucks, Tell thought, and uttered a wild little laugh. The fellow who had banged the door open, almost startling him into a scream, had progressed to the wash basins. Now the splashing, lathering sound of him washing his hands stopped briefly. Tell could imagine the newcomer listening, wondering who was laughing behind one of the closed stall doors, wondering if it was a joke, a dirty picture, or if the man was just crazy. There were, after all, lots of crazy people in New York. You saw them all the time, talking to themselves and laughing for no appreciable reason, the way Tell had just now. Tell tried to imagine Sneakers also listening, and couldn't. Suddenly, he didn't feel like laughing anymore. Suddenly, he just felt like getting out of there. He didn't want the man at the basin to see him, though. The man would look at him, just for a moment, but that would be enough to know what he was thinking. People who laughed behind closed toilet stall doors were not to be trusted. Click-clack of shoes on the old white hexagonal bathroom tiles, whoos of the door being opened, hish of it settling slowly back into place. You could bang it open, but the pneumatic elbow joint kept it from banging shut. That might upset the third-floor receptionist as he sat smoking Camels and reading the latest issue of Kerrang. God, it's so silent in here. Why doesn't the guy move? At least a little. But there was just the silence, thick and smooth and total. The sort of silence the dead would hear in their coffins if they could still hear. And Tell again became convinced that Sneakers was dead. Fuck logic, he was dead and had been dead for who know how long. He was sitting in there, and if you opened the door, you would see some slumped, mossy thing with its hands dangling between its thighs. You would see... For a moment, he was on the verge of calling, "Hey, Sneaks, you all right?" But what if Sneakers answered? Not in a questioning or irritated voice, but in a froggy, grinding croak. Wasn't there something about waking the dead, about... Suddenly Tell was up fast, flushing the toilet and buttoning his pants, out of the stall, zipping his fly as he headed for the door, aware that in a few seconds he was going to feel silly, but not caring. Yet he could not forbear one glance under the first stall as he passed. Dirty, white, mislaced sneakers, and dead flies. Quite a few of them. Weren't any dead flies in my stall? And just how is it that all this time has gone by and he still hasn't noticed that he missed one of the eyelets? Or does he wear them that way all the time as some kind of artistic statement? Tell hit the door pretty hard coming out. The receptionist just up the hall glanced at him with the cool curiosity he saved for beings merely mortal, as opposed to such deities in human form as Roger Daltrey. Tell hurried down the hall to Tabori Studios. Paul? What? Jannings answered without looking up from the board. Georgie Ronkler was standing off to one side, watching Jannings closely and nibbling a cuticle. Cuticles were all he had left to nibble. His fingernails simply did not exist above the point where they parted company with live flesh and hot nerve endings. He was close to the door. If Jannings began to rant, Georgie would slip through it. I think there might be something wrong in... Jannings groaned. Something else? What do you mean? This drum track is what I mean. It's badly botched, and I don't know what we can do about it. He flicked a toggle, and drums crashed into the studio. You hear it? The snare, you mean? Of course I mean the snare. It stands out a mile from the rest of the percussion, but it's married to it. Yes, but Jesus bloody fuck. I hate shit like this. 40 tracks I got here, 40 goddamn tracks to record, a simple bop tune, and some idiot technician. From the tail of his eye, Tell saw Georgie disappear like a cool breeze. But look, Paul, if you lower the equalization, the EQ's got nothing to do with... Shut up and listen a minute, Tell said soothingly, something he could have said to no one else on the face of the earth, and slid a switch. Jannings stopped ranting and started listening. He asked a question. Tell answered it. Then he asked one Tell couldn't answer. But Jannings was able to answer it himself, and all of a sudden they were looking at a whole new spectrum of possibilities for a song called Answer to You, Answer to Me. After a while, sensing that the storm had passed, Georgie Ronkler crept back in, and Tell forgot all about the sneakers. They returned to his mind the following evening. He was at home, sitting on the toilet in his own bathroom, reading Wise Blood while Vivaldi played mildly from the bedroom speakers. Although Tell now mixed rock and roll for a living, he owned only 4 rock records, 2 by Bruce Springsteen and 2 by John Fogerty. He looked up from his book, somewhat startled. A question of cosmic ludicrousness had suddenly occurred to him. How long has it been since you took a crap in the evening, John? He didn't know, but he thought he might be taking them then quite a bit more frequently in the future. At least one of his habits might change, it seemed. Sitting in the living room 15 minutes later, his book forgotten in his lap, something else occurred to him. He hadn't used the 3rd-floor restroom once that day. They had gone across the street for coffee at 10, and he had taken a whiz at the men's room of Donut Buddy while Paul and Georgie sat at the counter, drinking coffee and talking about overdubs. Then, on his lunch hour, he had made a quick pit stop at the Bruin Burger, and another on the 1st-floor late that afternoon when he had gone down to drop off a bunch of mail that he could have just as easily stuffed into the mail slot by the elevators. Avoiding the 3rd-floor men's? Was that what he'd been doing today without even realizing it? You bet your Reeboks it was. Avoiding it like a scared kid who goes a block out of his way coming home from school so he won't have to go past the local haunted house. Avoiding it like the plague. Well, so what? He said out loud. He couldn't exactly articulate the so what, but he knew there was one. There was something just a little too existential, even for New York, about getting spooked out of a public bathroom by a pair of dirty sneakers. Aloud, very clearly, Tell said, "This has got to stop." But that was Thursday night, and something happened on Friday night that changed everything. That was when the door closed between him and Paul Jannings. Tell was a shy man and didn't make friends easily. In the rural Pennsylvania town where he'd gone to high school, a quirk of fate had put Tell up on stage with a guitar in his hands, the last place he'd ever expected to be. The bassist of a group called the Satin Saturns fell ill with salmonella the day before a well-paying gig. The lead guitarist, who was also in the school band, knew John Tell could play both bass and rhythm. This lead guitarist was big and potentially violent. John Tell was small, humble, and breakable. The guitarist offered him a choice between playing the ill bassist instrument and having it rammed up his ass to the fifth fret. This choice had gone a long way toward clarifying his feelings about playing in front of a large audience. But by the end of the third song, he was no longer frightened. By the end of the first set, he knew he was home. Years after that first gig, Tell heard a story about Bill Wyman, bassist of the Rolling Stones. According to the story, Wyman actually nodded off during a performance. Not in some tiny club, mind you, but in a huge hall. And fell from the stage, breaking his collarbone. Tell supposed lots of people thought this story was apocryphal, but he himself had an idea it was true, and he was, after all, in a unique position to understand how something like that could happen. Bassists were the invisible men of the rock world. There were exceptions, Paul McCartney for one, but they only proved the rule. Perhaps because of the job's very lack of glamour, there was a chronic shortage of bass players. When the Satin Saturns broke up a month later, the lead guitarist and the drummer got into a fistfight over a girl. Tell joined a band formed by the Saturns' rhythm man, and his life's course was chosen as simply and quietly as that. Tell liked playing in the band. You were up front, looking down on everyone else, not just at the party, but making the party happen. You were simultaneously almost invisible and absolutely essential. Every now and then you had to sing a little backup, but nobody expected you to make a speech or anything. He had lived that life, part-time student and full-time band gypsy, for 10 years. He was good, but not ambitious. There was no fire in his belly. Eventually, he drifted into session work in New York, began fooling with the boards, and discovered he liked life even better on the far side of the glass window. During all that time, he had made one good friend, Paul Jennings. That had happened fast, and Tell supposed the unique pressures that went with the job had had something to do with it, but not everything. Mostly, he suspected, it had been a combination of two factors, his own essential loneliness and Jennings' personality, which was so powerful it was almost overwhelming. And it wasn't so different for Georgie, Tell came to realize, following what happened on that Friday night. He and Paul were having a drink at one of the back tables in McManus's pub, talking about the mix, the biz, the Mets, whatever, when all of a sudden Jennings' right hand was under the table and gently squeezing Tell's crotch. Tell moved away so violently that the candle in the center of the table fell over and Jennings' glass of wine spilled. A waiter came over and righted the candle before it could scorch the tablecloth, then left. Tell stared at Jennings, his eyes wide and shocked. "I'm sorry," Jennings said. And he did look sorry, but he also looked unperturbed. "Jesus Christ, Paul!" It was all he could think of to say, and it sounded hopelessly inadequate. "I thought you were ready, that's all," Jennings said. "I suppose I should have been a little more subtle." "Ready?" Tell repeated. "What do you mean, ready for what?" "To come out, to give yourself permission to come out." "I'm not that way," Tell said. But his heart was pounding very hard and fast. Part of it was outrage. Part was fear of the implacable certainty he saw in Jennings' eyes. Most of it was dismay. What Jennings had done had shut him out. "Let's let it go, shall we? We'll just order and make up our minds that it never happened." "Until you want it to," those implacable eyes added. "Oh, it happened all right," Tell wanted to say, but didn't. The voice of reason and practicality would not allow it, would not allow him to risk lighting Paul Jennings' notoriously short fuse. This was, after all, a good job, and the job per se wasn't all. He could use Roger Daltrey's tape in his portfolio even more than he could use 2 more weeks' salary. He would do well to be diplomatic and save the outraged young man act for another time. Besides, did he really have anything to feel outraged about? It wasn't as if Jennings had raped him after all. And that was really just the tip of the iceberg. The rest was this. His mouth closed because that was what his mouth had always done. It did more than close. It snapped shut like a bear trap, with all his heart below those interlocked teeth and all his head above. "All right," was all he said. It never happened. Tell slept badly that night, and what sleep he did get was haunted by bad dreams. One of Jennings groping him in McManus's was followed by one of the sneakers under the stall door, only in this one, Tell opened the door and saw Paul Jennings sitting there. He had died naked, and in a state of sexual excitement that somehow continued even in death, even after all this time. Paul's mouth dropped open with an audible creak. "That's right. I knew you were ready," the corpse said on a puff of greenly rotten air. And Tell woke himself up by tumbling onto the floor in a tangle of coverlet. It was 4 in the morning. The first touches of light were just creeping through the chinks between the buildings outside his window. He dressed and sat smoking one cigarette after another until it was time to go to work. Around 11 o'clock on that Saturday, they were working six-day weeks to make Daltrey's deadline. Tell went into the third-floor men's room to urinate. He stood just inside the door, rubbing his temples, and then looked around at the stalls. He couldn't see. The angle was wrong. Then never mind, fuck it. Take your piss and get out of here. He walked slowly over to one of the urinals and unzipped. It took a long time to get going. On his way out, he paused again, head cocked like Nipper the dogs on the old RCA Victor record labels, and then turned around. He walked slowly back around the corner, stopping as soon as he could see under the door of the first stall. The dirty white sneakers were still there. The building, which used to be known as Music City, was almost completely empty, Saturday morning empty. But the sneakers were still there. Tell's eyes fixed upon a fly just outside the stall. He watched with an empty sort of avidity as it crawled beneath the stall door and onto the dirty toe of one of the sneakers. There it stopped and simply fell dead. It tumbled into the growing pile of insect corpses around the sneakers. Tell saw with no surprise at all, none he felt anyway, that among the flies were two small spiders and one large cockroach lying on its back like an upended turtle. Tell left the men's room in large, painless strides, and his progress back to the studio seemed most peculiar. It was as if, instead of him walking, the building was flowing past him, around him, like river rapids around a rock. "When I get back, I'll tell Paul I don't feel well and take the rest of the day off," he thought. But he wouldn't. Paul had been in an erratic, unpleasant mood all morning, and Tell knew he was part, or maybe all, of the reason why. Might Paul fire him out of spite? A week ago, he would have laughed at such an idea, but a week ago, he had still believed what he had come to believe in his growing up. Friends were real, and ghosts were make-believe. Now, he was starting to wonder if maybe he hadn't gotten those two postulates turned around somehow. "The prodigal returns," Janning said without looking around, as Tell opened the second of the studio's two doors, the one that was called the dead air door. "I thought you died in there, Johnny." "No," Tell said. "Not me."